Blog Talk Radio.
Making Sense with Steve Legend.
Hello, everyone. It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser. I'm your host, Steve Laser, and I thank you for deciding to spend the next hour with me. We have a packed show for you today with a very special guest. We'll start off with an interview with the Rude Pundit. We'll be talking about the Senator Menendez prostitution allegations and the Rand Paul filibuster. You won't want to miss that. He provides some of the most colorful commentary in politics today. He almost wore out my audio software's bleep function. Then we're going to talk about, are banks, some of them at least, too big to prosecute? And then unemployment reaches a four-year low. But are Republicans happy about that? As always, we will finish with our trademark weekly hall of fame and shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. If we have time, we will have our reader feedback segment, where this week's topic will be the tenure of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. If you want to write to me and give your opinion of Hugo Chavez or any other topic I cover, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may just read your opinion on the air, and that's regardless of whether it is in agreement with me or not. We'll get started with our first segment right after a word from one of our sponsors. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, B-A-D-L-E-R.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. Welcome back. I conducted an interview with the Rude Pundit about the allegations surrounding New Jersey Senator Menendez and also the Rand Paul filibuster. Now, I've bleeped out any bad words, but I still think I should warn listeners that some material may not be appropriate for children. Let's listen.
I want to welcome the Rude Pundit to Making Sense. If you're not familiar with the Rude Pundit, he operates a blog at rudepundit.blogspot.com, and he is known for his sharp commentary that is, sprinkled liberally with salty language. So welcome to Making Sense, sir.
Thanks a lot for having me, Steve.
Well, you know, I am really happy to have you on the show. I saw a couple of posts on your blog the other day that I thought really made a lot of sense, no pun intended. And the article in particular that first attracted me to wanting to have you on the show was about the Senator Menendez Tucker Carlson situation. So I wanted to get your take on that situation. And for listeners who don't know, can you bring us up to date? Why is Senator Menendez being investigated, first of all?
Well, he was investigated, actually. I think the investigation itself by the FBI is over because there were I guess, for lack of a better word, in the Dominican Republic, who were claiming on video that Menendez paid them to have sex, and so this was a story that was actually brought to several legit news outlets. It was brought to Politico, it was brought to ABC News, and then they just sort of went down the food chain to see who would actually bite the story. And there were these lawyers that actually had these video affidavits that they had taken from the aforementioned. So they eventually got to the bottom of the bottom feeders and found Tucker Carlson wallowing around in his own as he usually does. And and he and his Daily Caller publication, which is something I refer to as, well, what the f*** else is Tucker Carlson going to do with his time? And they ran with the story and tried to discredit Menendez, who was also on this trip to the Dominican Republic. He went on a private jet that was paid for by a lobbyist. I mean, there are things to look at in this. But what then happened is that the Washington Post decided to do some reporting and actually talk to one of the prostitutes, and that prostitute said that she had been given a script to read. And so then the Daily Caller, Tucker Carlson's website, said, "Ah, well, I guess we should check this," and they stand by the story. But it has moved very far down on the front page of the Daily Caller. In fact, it's practically non-existent now there. And the FBI did, as the Washington Post reported, conducted interviews and found no evidence to back up the tipster's allegations. So, you know, and you had some, you know, you had, you know, reporters like Brian Ross at ABC, who is no stranger to reporting scandals and is not afraid to break things that are scandals. You had him saying, no, there's nothing here.
So let me recap a couple of things that you just said. So
sure.
Senator Menendez, he's the Democratic senator from New Jersey, right?
Yes.
And, of course, coincidence that Tucker Carlson, who's a Republican and shills for the all things conservative and Republican, happens to be interested in a Democrat who might be in trouble.
Right.
And so Tucker Carlson writes this article. There's some investigation. The FBI gets involved. And then it turns out at least one of the people who reported this said that they were fed a script by, if I'm not mistaken, by an attorney.
Right.
And she claims that the actual incident never occurred.
Yes.
And now, despite that, Tucker Carlson, you're saying, is not backing down. He's saying the investigation should continue.
Right. He's saying that they stand by their reporting. I think my favorite thing is they talked to the wrong prostitutes, that the Washington Post talked to the wrong prostitutes. And I'm like, all right, you know, it's the Dominican Republic, you know. Nothing against the Dominican Republic, but I'm sure that there's many, many prostitutes one could talk to. I think that they could find out which prostitute it was.
Right. And, you know, look, it is an icky thing, and we would hope that none of our, you know, elected officials do it. But the other thing to point out is it's not illegal in the Dominican Republic, is it?
It's not illegal. And then I think my favorite detail in the Daily Caller story is that he agreed that Menendez apparently agreed, according to the two women, that they would that he would pay them $500 for, you know, I guess, I don't know, we'll go with double-teaming him or something. You know, imagine whatever you would do with two prostitutes at once.
Okay.
Whether it was to watch, I don't know how far you'd like me to go with the details of what one could do with two prostitutes, but and what implements one might use in that situation.
Okay, I think we're getting too far now.
Anyway, so, but then they received only $100 each, and so they were pissed off, and therefore that would be their motivation, I guess, according to the Daily Caller, in coming forward.
Okay.
Menendez had just not, you know, had not tried to cheat them on their money, that they wouldn't have gone like Elliot Spitzer's prostitute.
Okay, but so far, any attempt to corroborate this has been met with somebody who said that that's not actually what happened. Now,
right.
Now,
in fact, what one of the women says is that a local lawyer, this is actually a quote, a local lawyer approached her and a fellow escort and asked them to help frame Menendez and another person.
Wow.
So, and that they gave them a script and they paid the prostitute to read the script out loud.
Wow. I mean, there's so much that's disgusting about how this whole thing happened. One of them, obviously, is it seems like Senator Menendez was framed here. But the other thing is, even if he wasn't framed, there would be quite a double standard for how Carlson and the Daily Caller treated him versus how they treated various other sex scandals by Republicans, right? I mean, I think you mentioned David Vitter on your site, right?
Right, and this was – I don't think the Daily Caller wasn't around when Vitter's – David Vitter, the senator from Louisiana's sex scandal, came out. But Carlson had a TV show on MSNBC, and it was called Tucker, which rhymes with lots of fun things. And so on Tucker, he had a guest on who had posted the names of people that were on this New Orleans madam's call list. And so Carlson invited this guy on his show, which was on MSNBC. And again, let's remember, whenever everybody starts talking about MSNBC being the Fox of the left, it's like, no, their business model wasn't based on that because of shows like Tucker. And you know, let's not forget that, and I'm getting way far afield here, so if you want me to...
No, that's back, okay. I mean, The Morning Joe, for instance, 2 hours in the morning.
Let's not forget that Michael Savage had his show on MSNBC. So it's not as if they started MSNBC with the idea that, you know, we're going to be the liberal counterweight to Fox. It's evolved. Its nighttime lineup has evolved in that direction. But anyway, so Tucker's on the air. Why? Nobody knows. Because what the hell else is Tucker Carlson going to do? What good is he to the world? And so so he has this guy on who released this list, Michael Rechtenwald. And he starts badgering this guy about how can you justify doing this, you know? Why is this any of your business? That David Vitter broke the law. A senator who is sworn to uphold the Constitution upon which the laws are made broke the law and was, you know, and was actually So he was willing to say, Carlson, that it's none of our business if an elected senator is, by more or less his own admission, but yet, by the same token, he is going to go after Menendez to investigate to see whether or not prostitutes were boned.
You know, it's amazing. Republicans seem to get away with this crap all the time. You see, you got me doing it here. Now I'm starting to use more colorful metaphors. But, you know, they get away and they do this crap a lot. Newt Gingrich, Bob Livingston, Pete Domenici, all of these guys attacked President Clinton for having an affair. They wanted him impeached. Pete Domenici cast a vote to impeach President Clinton. Bob Livingston in the House helped draw up the impeachment charges. Turns out they were all having affairs.
Yeah, but when their affair, just to give a little difference in, again, how the Republican Party has evolved since the time of Newt Gingrich, you know, you remember those days when you thought, oh, the things can't get any worse than this, you know, terrible Newt Gingrich. But when Newt Gingrich is, when the ethical compromises and violations that he had came out, he resigned.
Right.
And left in disgrace.
As did Livingston.
Same with Livingston.
Right.
And but Vitter, not only did he serve out his term, but he ran again and got reelected.
And reelected, yeah.
Because and you know and so this is a level of hypocrisy by the Republicans that they never get called out on. That oh, he repented or something like that. He had one of those press conferences. Well. He, you know, where he said, I have shamed my family. He never specifically admitted to wrongdoing, but, you know, if you're shaming your family, then you're doing what the madam of the brothel says you're doing.
Right. No, you know, and I get your point about Livingston and Gingrich, but I think Vitter, I think Sanford, and I think Domenici, these are guys who served out terms, or in case of Domenici, never got caught while he was an elected official. But
right.
Yet, you know, the Republican Party still tries to claim it's the party of family values. That's what gets me. I don't care what that Vitter's still a senator, really. I mean, it doesn't really bother me, as long as Republicans wouldn't go after Democrats in the same situation. I agree, in essentially, with what Tucker Carlson said about Vitter. The only thing is they don't practice that in the other direction.
Well, and then we have, in the same interview that Carlson was doing on his show, And this is one of those, like, you know, it's one of those moments where it's like you're getting a job while shooting up heroin, and moments, And where you come across a piece of information where you're just like, oh wow, that's skeevier than usual. So while Carlson is haranguing this guy for, you know, you should be ashamed of yourself, he says, Carlson proclaimed on that show, if this were Russ Feingold, who's a Democratic senator, or was at the time a Democratic senator, I would be up there making the same argument that Russ Feingold's personal life ought to be off limits from creeps and scandal mongers like you who profit from digging into other people's sex lives.
And when he was saying that, he was lying through his teeth.
Well, he was lying, but it sounded good at the time. It made him sound, holier than thou about approving or about turning a blind eye to mongering.
Unbelievable.
And so here we have a chance for him to prove that what he said on the air, and of course he goes in the total other direction.
That's Republicans for you. That's our favorite party of the opposition.
And the reason the Democrats always have to purge anybody from our party who is caught doing anything that's, you know, outside of that's anything sexually deviant or suspicious is because we have to keep making up for the fact that the Republicans portray Democrats as not the family values party, when in reality, yeah, we are, you know, the guy in the White House right now is more of a family man than, you know, most of the Republicans that have ever been in the White House.
Absolutely. You know, I think Republicans, they owe an apology to President Clinton. I think they owe an apology to Mr. Wiener, who was a great congressman up until the time he got in trouble. He didn't break any laws, if I recall. I mean, he did something that was, like you said, a little skeevy, a little sleazy.
Right.
But he didn't break the law.
No. He did not. I mean, and this was something that was between him and his wife.
Yeah.
And you know, it could have really been a learning moment of, you know, Christ, this is what the internet has done to us. You know, it's made us all more vulnerable in that way to this kind of thing. You know, how many of us have not been tempted to, you know, show our over on Twitter? Every day is something that I have to suppress.
Well, I think we'll end that segment on that note. But you wrote about something else yesterday on your blog that also actually got my attention, and it was about the Rand Paul filibuster. He threw an old-fashioned filibuster at the Brennan confirmation hearings yesterday. He talked for 13 hours straight. What was his filibuster about? And you know, he claimed it had something to do with Brenner. It really wasn't about Brenner exactly, was it?
No, it wasn't about John Brennan, who's up to be, who was nominated and now was voted in to be CIA director. It was a very specific issue that he had problems with, that he wasn't getting. He was questioning the Attorney General about whether or not the president felt that whether or not the Attorney General felt the president had the authority to order drone strikes on American citizens on U.S. soil without any warrant authorization beyond whatever authorization the initial Afghanistan and Iraq war authorizations gave, the fight against Al-Qaeda and its, you know, and its associates authorization from 2001.
You know, I thought about that when he said it, and I still think that is one of the most ridiculous things that I have ever heard. Now, I understand some of my progressive friends, you might even think that that was a good thing that he did it. But honestly, if you're the president and you're going to do something bad, right, you're going to break the law, you're going to try to kill somebody, are you going to do it with a drone on U.S. soil where it's obviously that the government did this? Or are you going to arrange for the guy to have a car accident or something? I mean, is that what he did useful in any way?
The only thing, because it was so narrowly focused, I mean, there were lots of progressives that thought, this is great, he's bringing attention to drones. I wish he'd have brought more attention to the unchecked surveillance that the NSA can do, that Congress seems to be unwilling to do anything about. I wish he'd have brought attention to drone strikes overseas, which have done more harm than good in the long run to America and its safety. But he was narrowly focused, and he was pissed off because he wanted Holder to clarify something. Holder had said sent him a letter, and as him and other senators, saying that, let's just say for shits and giggles that that there's planes that are heading towards towards the Empire State Building or the White House. Yes, at that moment we could use drones to take them out, even if they were American citizens who were flying those planes. You know, if the way he put it was a 9/11 or Pearl Harbor scenario.
Mm-hmm. Which
that's the way Holder put it.
Which makes sense.
You know, I'm as liberal as they come on most things, and I have to say that, you know, sorry, in that scenario, you know, if I was one of those people that if they had ordered a fighter jet to take out one of the planes, the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania, that was, you know, one of the conspiracy things is that it was shot down,
mm-hmm,
rather than it was the people on the inside.
Yeah, I would have been okay with that.
Yeah, I would have been like, yeah, well, yeah, that's what you do. You prevent the major metropolitan area from having a plane collide in it.
Yeah.
And so, but Rand Paul wanted more clarification. Could the president have ordered a drone strike on Jane Fonda? Because during the Vietnam War, she went and met with the North Vietnamese. When she came back to America, could he have sent something to take out Jane Fonda in her home in California?
Right.
And that was really what the whole 13-hour dance was about.
Now, should Democrats, liberals, progressives, should we be celebrating Rand Paul now for doing this? Should Democrats in Kentucky vote for him next time as a result? I mean, I think I know what you're going to say, but go ahead.
Mostly I'm going to say, you know, f*** that guy. I'm sorry. First of all, the messenger matters. And here's a guy who, in virtually every other way, has appalled progressives. And just because, you know, his clock happens to have hit the right, hit the time, you know, once in a while, twice a day, I don't think that we should be celebrating that. I think what should have happened is that there should be more talking filibusters. That if there's anything we should be celebrating about this, it's he demonstrated why the filibuster should be reformed.
Yeah, you know, I love Senator Harry Reid. I was really hopeful when he talked about filibuster reform that's one of the things that he was going to do, that he was going to mandate, all right, you want a filibuster, you want to stop the Senate from moving on something even when 58, 59 of us want to do it, you need to get up there and you need to keep talking and talking and talking. That shows us that you're serious about filibustering.
Right, and not this, you know, what this procedural matter that it's become. That it becomes something significant. It goes back to that Mr. Smith goes to Washington drama.
Right.
I mean, the Bernie Sanders filibuster in 2010 was great, and it actually, you know, that filibuster, it was part of the Occupy Wall Street movement in a way, and it was part of a movement that shifted the conversation away from just debt and brought income disparity into the spotlight, and to get at least that being discussed. Because Paul's filibuster was so narrowly focused on a question that Eric Holder then answered in a two-second, you know, blimey of a letter, you know, what was the letter? I mean, I think you can practically quote the letter. You have an additional question as to whether or not the president can authorize the use of drone missile attacks on American soil for an American citizen who is not engaged in combat against the United States. The answer is no. That was it. That was essentially Holder just taking both of his hands and slapping them on his groin and saying, I got your answer right here, Rand.
You know, you made an interesting comparison in your article between Rand Paul and another organization, a church organization. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, the thing about the Westboro Baptist Church, which are, that's the God Hates Fags organization, the ones that show up at military funerals and hold up the signs and show, but they show up in lots of places. And they don't get attention for when they show up at, say, well, for instance, on Monday, they're going to be at a Catholic church in, and I believe they're going to be in Missouri, Missouri or Kansas, and they're going to be protesting the Catholic church there because they are against child rape.
Right.
And progressives generally have a low opinion of child rape.
So do most of the country. Yeah.
Yes, most of the country. Should we all then be joining with the Westboro Baptist Church?
Not a chance.
In protesting the Catholic Church?
Yeah, no way.
And they've protested other things that, you know, I'm sure that if Donald Trump died, they would be at that funeral. And, you know, I'd be hard-pressed to sit there and go, yeah, why not let them cause some trouble there? but we're not gonna, because they're absolutely appalling messengers. And why would we want to associate with that? Why would we want to give them any kind of credibility at all just because they happen to, at one point, say something against something that we also are against?
That's a good point. That's a good point. Well, since Rand Paul's gesture was essentially meaningless, let's you and I talk about a little bit about drones here for just a minute and do something meaningful. I asked Medea Benjamin from Code Pink, the same question I'm about to ask you. I had her on my show a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that you're one of the president's advisors, and someone comes into the Oval Office where you and the president are discussing issues, and they inform you that there is a group of Al-Qaeda members in the tribal areas of Pakistan who are in the latter stages of planning a terrorist attack on several American cities. What would your advice be to the president? Would you advise him to use drones, or what would you advise?
I feel a little awkward doing this because, you know, it's sort of like, oh, look at the dovey liberal now wants to, you know, feel a little bloodthirsty. It was the way I felt, the way most liberals felt about Afghanistan. It was like, yeah, get those f***ers, finally, we have something that we can actually be, you know, warriors about, you know, after all of these stupid friggin' wars that we've been dragged into. Here's one that we can get behind. Even though there were a lot of us that were saying, yeah, you know, maybe we should treat this like a crime, 9/11. But given that choice that you gave me,
mm-hmm.
I would say send in the special forces.
Okay.
That's what they do. You know, that's their job. And their job is to do the SEAL Team 6 kind of stuff and disrupt it. And if we have ears on the ground there that know about it, then they know where they are. But our use of airstrikes and our use of drones, missiles from drones, has the collateral damage of that has harmed us in so many ways and has merely made given the terrorists reason to say to people in the nations where they are, look, see what these bastards are like.
This is why we go on. That's a really good point. Well, sir, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today. The Rude Pundit, his website is rudepundit.blogspot.com. I hope you will come on the show again. I really enjoyed it.
I'd love to. And, let me plug the Twitter,
sure.
Which is @RudePundit. And I may as well plug the book, since the book still has lots of stuff in it that's valid. The Rude Pundit's Almanac 2012 edition. You can get it at orbooks.com.
Oh, great. I'm going to go get it right now myself, actually. And again, thanks very much, sir.
Thanks a lot.
Have a good one.
Making Sense with Steve Laser. We'll be right back.
Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on. Go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on. Get paid.
Welcome back. Are some banks too big to prosecute? The Hill reported this week on testimony of Attorney General Eric Holder before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Now, Attorney General Holder, he was asked a number of questions about the lack of a high-profile prosecution of a senior banking official in the wake of all the apparent fraud and other wrongdoing that led to the financial crisis that nearly wrecked the entire economy between 2007 and 2009. Mr. Holder had this to say.
I am concerned that the size of some of these institutions becomes so large that it does become difficult for us to prosecute them when we are hit with indications that if you do prosecute, if you do bring a criminal charge, it will have a negative impact on the national economy, perhaps even the world economy. And I think that is a function of the fact that some of these institutions have become too large.
Now, to me, this is just incredible. Our government fears prosecuting some banks and senior members of some banks because of the effect it might have on the economy? I have to say, a lot of friends of mine in the liberal and progressive blogosphere and many other Democratic-leaning pundits focused their disappointment about this at Eric Holder. I understand it, but quite frankly, I don't see this as Eric Holder's fault or problem. This is something that has come about over the last 20 to 30 years, and it needs to be addressed by the broader government, both the legislative and executive branches. If doing something about these banks and the people who run them would hurt the economy, then I don't want Eric Holder to act until something is done about the size of the banks. Then have Holder or whoever is attorney general at that point arrest those responsible for the 2007 and 2009 mortgage crisis. A law should be passed that sets some standard of measurement for bank size and says that beyond that measurement, which gets indexed to the GDP, banks have to be broken up. And that should be pursued vigorously. Any situation where a corporation or other entity is so big and has so many assets that the law enforcement apparatus of this country has to fear addressing wrongdoing by that entity or its officers is too big to exist. The big banks should be broken up. Too big to fail or too big to prosecute is too big to exist. The top 10 or top 20 banks in the U.S. are probably all too big to exist. Let's say we set as the largest possible size for a bank that it had no more assets than 1% of the GDP of this country. That's an enormous number. The GDP of the United States is $15 trillion. 1% of that is $150 billion. Now, it turns out that the 17 largest banks in the country would exceed that metric. That's how much assets these folks have. The two largest banks in the United States, J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America, both have assets exceeding $2 trillion. No wonder the government is afraid to do something that would hurt those banks. Those two largest banks have assets totaling nearly a third of our country's entire GDP. That's just too big. Now, by the way, if we set our metric at 2% of GDP, or $300 billion in total assets, you'd have only the top 10 banks in the U.S. being too big to exist. That would be okay, too, in my opinion. Now, I know what those who would have an issue with this are going to say. Part of why it makes sense to have banks with assets that large is that you almost need that to be a bank with global reach. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and the number three bank in terms of assets, which is Citigroup, they're all banks with branches all over the globe. And those banks cater to U.S. companies that have operations around the world. But you know what? I have a feeling if we set it at $300 billion or $150 billion in total assets, the metric for not going beyond, banks would figure out a way to survive at $150 or $300 billion and still have a global reach. I'm sure you can run a global operation if you have assets in that amount. Still a huge amount of money. But getting back to my main point, you cannot have a functional democracy when there are entities in the country with a lot of power that operate above the law. Any bank that has hundreds of billions in assets or more, or even trillions in assets, is a powerful organization. If we cannot take them to task for their bad behavior when they exhibit it, we no longer have a functional democracy. The entities in question did some very ugly things in the recent past, and for that, they need to be held accountable. If we can't do that now, we need to fix it so that we can. Making Sense. We'll be right back. Welcome back, and now it's time for our listener feedback section. Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, died this week from complications from cancer. What does it mean for Latin America and Venezuela and American relations with both? And what do you think of his tenure in office? Was it good for Venezuela or was it bad for Venezuela? Hugo Chavez was one of the more polarizing figures in the world. Most people either loved him or hated him. He regularly thumbed his nose at the United States. He formed a long-lasting relationship with Fidel Castro in Cuba and Iran's Ahmadinejad. His election was the beginning of a movement throughout South America that saw elections of left-leaning and anti-American leaders like Evo Morales in Bolivia and Rafael Correa in Ecuador. Chavez nationalized the petroleum industry in Venezuela and initiated a number of other reforms. The pro-Chavez folks point to a number of key economic indicators that show that GDP growth has gone up, unemployment has gone down, poverty has gone down, and the amount of retired people receiving pensions has gone way up under Chavez versus the previous administration in Venezuela. The folks who are against Chavez point to the fact that Venezuela has an income from sales of oil of $100 million per day, and they feel that's enough to offset any poor economic decisions as long as one isn't stealing all of the proceeds. Those folks also suggest that the economy of Venezuela in the 1970s was better than it was under Chavez. There's also the suggestion by the anti-Chavez crowd that Chavez was a dictator who restricted freedoms of the press and opposition parties. On the other side of things, Chavez conducted a weekly, several hours long television program where he took direct questions from citizens about all types of government functions. And he would take to task government officials on the air and ask them to respond to citizens as appropriate in real time. So what's your opinion? Email me at makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may just read your email on the air. Again, that is makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. Making Sense. We'll be right back.
Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on. Go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on.
Welcome back. The job numbers for February came out this past Friday, and they show that unemployment has reached a four-year low. Nothing gives Republican politicians gastric distress like a Democratic president with an improving economy. The unemployment rate dropped to 7.7% as employers added 236,000 jobs in February. According to the AP, the hiring has been fueled by steady improvement in housing, auto sales, manufacturing, and corporate profits, along with record low borrowing rates. The Wall Street Journal's Phil Izzo talked about another interesting way to look at job numbers. See, Republicans like to claim that President Obama is for big government and has been expanding the government, but the Wall Street Journal showed how untrue that was. There are nearly 950,000 fewer workers employed by local, state, and federal governments since the recovery began midway through President Obama's first year in office in 2009. If those cuts had not happened, the Wall Street Journal estimates that the unemployment rate would be at 7.1%. Now, that's an interesting thing to keep in mind when one considers the Republican approach that they want to take with the budget. Not just the budget, but the fiscal cliff and the sequester. Now, I'll get back to that in just a minute. Republicans in general don't like to see the economy improve under a Democratic president. That's really why they hated President Clinton and ultimately had to gin up a reason to try to impeach him. A Democratic president who improves the economy shatters the myth that Republicans have been carefully cultivating since the presidencies of Carter and Reagan, that Democratic presidents are bad for the economy and Republican presidents are good for the economy. Republicans get very upset when that myth starts being challenged by reality. The fact is, and I'll talk about this more during an upcoming show, Carter was unlucky enough to become president at the wrong time, and Reagan was lucky enough to become president at the right time. The performance of the economy under their presidencies had nothing to do with their economic policies. But getting back to the latest job data and Republican reactions, you would think that any American would be happy about the economy improving and more people getting jobs. A strange thing, though, has happened every month that there has been positive information, and there have been a lot of months with positive information, under President Obama. That strange thing is typified by the statement House Speaker John Boehner released in response to the job numbers. Boehner's statement read in part, Any job creation is positive news. But the fact is, unemployment in America is still way above the levels the Obama White House projected when the $1 trillion stimulus spending bill was enacted. And the federal government's ongoing spending binge has resulted in a debt that exceeds the size of our entire economy, end quote. Now, the rest of his statement went on to say all kinds of terrible things about Obama's handling of the economy. Republicans just cannot stand it when a Democratic president has a positive effect on the economy. It gives them agita, ulcers, and whatever other gastric distress problems you can name. It's really amazing. I mean, the first six words of Boehner's statement are somewhat positive, like he felt he had to throw that in there not to sound like a complete jerk, but that was it. Now, I wish I could show you all graphs on the radio. A graph from the Labor Department tracks the unemployment rate from the start of the Bush recession in 2007 to its peak in mid-2009 through the Obama recovery. It's really striking. Unemployment went from around 5% in 2007 to over 10% at the height of the recession in mid to late 2009, and now has fallen to 7.7%. Obama's policies have cut unemployment by nearly 2.5%. That's huge. Now, I'm going to post that graph from the Labor Department on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com by the end of the day on Monday, because it really puts an exclamation point on how great of a job President Obama has done in managing the economy. Is it too much to ask for Republicans to just once, just one time, when the monthly job numbers are released and it shows improvement, can they just once just issue a statement saying that this is a good thing with no added snarks or attacks on the president? Is that really too much to ask? I think there's been only one time in President Obama's presidency when the Republicans complimented him without including an attack in the same statement, and that is when he got Osama bin Laden. That was it. And they pretty much had to do it then, though. There was no choice. Even then, you could see them gritting their teeth when they said it. President Obama did a good thing in getting Osama bin Laden. I mean, Republicans have gotten to a point where they are just so petty. And predictably so. Making Sense with Steve Laser. We'll be right back with our Hall of Fame and Shame after this. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, BADLER.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. Welcome back. And now it's time for our Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and other individuals making great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. Two people share the award this week, Iowa Senator Tom Harkin and Representative George Miller of California's 11th District. Senator Harkin and Representative Miller, both Democrats, have submitted bills to raise the national minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. The current federal minimum wage, for comparison, is $7.25 per hour. That's a number that's pretty hard to contemplate. I mean, it's hard to imagine people actually living on a wage that low. That's $290 a week before taxes, or around $15,000 per year. Now, states, of course, are free to set their own minimum wages, and 19 of them have set minimum wages higher than the federal minimum. Washington State has the highest minimum wage at $9.19 an hour, followed by Oregon at $8.95 per hour and Vermont at $8.60 an hour. The amount proposed by Senator Harkin and Representative Miller is actually lower than the purchasing power the federal minimum wage gave workers back in 1968. You see, in 1968, when the federal minimum wage was raised to $1.60 an hour, the equivalent of that amount in 2012 wages would be $10.64 an hour. Still, the new bill would be a massive improvement for American workers currently receiving the minimum wage. Workers working a standard full-time week of 40 hours would earn $404 a week before taxes, or approximately $21,000 per year. That's enough to where a single parent with two children would make more than the federal poverty level. In the richest country in the world, where we have so many people with so much wealth, it makes sense to ensure that even the poorest among us make above the poverty level. So congratulations to Senator Harkin and Representative Miller for their share of winning this week's Hall of Fame for Making Sense. Moving on to those who made the Hall of Shame this week for infamous nonsense. In third place this week in our Hall of Shame, we have Citibank, Wells Fargo, and several other of the big banks. Now, I couldn't believe this story when I first read it, and as someone who is former active duty enlisted Air Force, I am still completely appalled. A report by Newser.com sheds light on how several of America's biggest banks wrongly foreclosed on the homes of 700 active duty service people while some of them were deployed and serving in places like Afghanistan. Now, the banks have admitted they made these mistakes, and the information comes out of a larger investigation into foreclosure abuse during the housing crisis. Banks have an additional obligation, according to federal law, when foreclosing on active duty military. They are supposed to get a court order before they foreclose on active duty troops. Now, I'm guessing that this is, you know, in part because some of these folks can be on extended deployment and may not know that anything is wrong and whoosh, their house is gone, right? In this case, that didn't happen. Those houses were foreclosed and that was that. As I said, the banks have admitted this. You notice I didn't use the word alleged anywhere in this piece. This is admitted wrongdoing by the banks, who have said that they intend to compensate those affected, not only in the military, but civilians who were wrongly foreclosed. I don't know what compensated means, because the banks were not specific. But I'll tell you what it should mean. It should mean that any folks wrongly foreclosed, be they military or civilian, should get their homes free and clear. I don't understand how a bank is so recklessly callous that they make a mistake on a foreclosure and take someone's home away. If you're going to take someone's home away, the least amount of decency you owe is to make sure you're not making a mistake in doing so, don't you think? Citibank, Wells Fargo, and any other banks responsible are third this week in our Hall of Shame for worst nonsense of the week. In second place for even worse nonsense, we have the administration of the Gresham-Barlow School District in Oregon. Now, according to an article in the Oregonian by Janet Goetz, North Gresham Elementary School Principal Tom Clancic was approached by the parent of one of his students, Denise McLeod, with a proposal to start an anti-bullying program in the school. Ms. McLeod had heard news reports of 11- and 13-year-old children committing suicide after bullying episodes. Soon, she was working to develop the anti-bullying program alongside Principal Clancic and school counselor Nancy DeClark. A plan was developed for an anti-bullying week. The students sang songs at assembly like Katy Perry's Firework. They made and wore pink T-shirts, and they learned that they can all stand together to stop bullying. Excuse me. This all sounds great, right? The Oregonian thought so too, and thus printed the article that provides most of the details that I just talked about. But as an article the next day on the website of KOIN Local 6 in Oregon pointed out, the administration of the Gresham-Barlow School District didn't think it was so great. The day after the article talking about the anti-bullying efforts appeared, it became public that the principal's contract was not being renewed. Coincidence? Maybe. But it also came out recently that Principal Klancic is gay. And his attorney said that this, along with the anti-bullying effort, is why the principal is being let go. His attorney, Judy Snyder, said that they will be filing a lawsuit against the school district. One of the things Ms. Snyder noted is that, quote, he's had a great deal of difficulty getting specifics as to what he has failed to do to meet performance expectations. He's been a very successful principal, and he's continued to be a very successful principal even under close scrutiny of the last 2 years, end quote. Now, obviously, at this point, a lot of what is happening are allegations, but it seems wrong. Something about this smells wrong. The parents seem very happy with Principal Klancic. Many of them are speaking out to local media. The district doesn't seem to have been forthcoming with any indications of poor performance. It just sounds bad. When asked by KOIN Local 6 for comment, an administration spokesperson said, quote, it's not our policy to discuss personnel matter. Under Oregon state law, anything within an employee's file is confidential, end quote. In a situation like this, that is not good enough. The administration works for the parents and children of their district, and they deserve to know why things are being done in their name. Something seems wrong here. The administration of the Gresham Barlow School District earns its spot as runner-up in this week's Hall of Shame for making nonsense. The award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to Celeste Gregg, president of the California Republican Assembly. Folks, they did it again. One of them did it again. We have another Todd Akin in the Republican Party. What is this now, the fifth, sixth, or seventh Republican who has done this in the last year? I lose count. What's different about it this time is we have a woman who now is trying to override biology with ideology. According to Mercury News out of Silicon Valley, California, Celeste Gregg, president of the California Republican Assembly, decided to weigh in on what happened last year with Todd Akin. Now, she was on the right track. She said that it was an insensitive remark that she thought Mr. Akin probably regretted and he should apologize. She should have stopped there, because the next thing out of her mouth was, quote, granted the percentage of pregnancies due to rape is small because it's an act of violence, because the body is traumatized. I don't know what percentage of pregnancies are due to the violence of rape because of the trauma the body goes through. I don't know what percentage of pregnancy results from the act. Now, unbelievably, she basically said the same thing that Akin did after first criticizing him for it. The upshot of what she said and what Akin said is exactly the same, that the fact that it is rape and not consensual sex somehow alters the chance of pregnancy. It's not true. And as reported by the Mercury News, California Democratic Assemblywoman Nancy Skinner from Berkeley said, if a woman is near ovulating or ovulating, and sperm comes in direct contact, she gets pregnant. It doesn't matter what the nature of the act was. It's just outrageous beyond absurd. It's insinuating, it's insulting. It's the same line of thinking of if we just dress differently or behave differently, we won't be raped. They're basically saying while we're being raped, if we hate it enough, we won't get pregnant, end quote. Amen, Ms. Skinner. Amen. Now, I thought it was bad when the last Republican said it because they were an OBGYN. Representative Phil Gingrey, a Republican congressman from Georgia and a former OBGYN. Now we have a woman saying it. That's just, I'm speechless. These guys have finally made me speechless. Wow. Okay, let's recover here. Stephen Harmon of the Mercury News writes in his article that Celeste Gregg is the president of the Conservative California Republican Assembly, the state's oldest and largest GOP volunteer organization. Ronald Reagan once called it, quote, the conscience of the Republican Party, end quote. What a joke that is. Ms. Gregg earns her spot as winner of the Hall of Shame this week for infamous nonsense. That's all I have for today's show. Thank you very much for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, March 17th, and Monday, March 18th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Until next time, have a great day and a great rest of your week.